Greetings, everyone. Happy Halloween. The politics of H.P. Lovecraft have always been considered a liability by those who appreciate his work. Though upon reading a few of his letters from the final 7 years of his life, which ended in 1937, I was surprised by what I discovered. His radical political transformation in 1931, so at odds with the man that many know as H.P. Lovecraft, is a chapter of the writer's life that many seem to be unfamiliar with. Like other Lovecraft devotees, I've tried to learn to separate aesthetic value from moral value. Lovecraft was a reactionary and a white supremacist, and this can be detected in his work. Sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's staring you right in the face. Nevertheless, he's a literary genius and one of the greatest horror authors of all time. Occasionally, his fans will step out on a limb, defending aspects of his character. Patton Oswalt once suggested that Lovecraft, had he been given the chance to grow old, may have matured in his old age. Perhaps he would have become an even worse crank, but there's a chance that he would have swerved in the other direction. His introspective and hypercritical nature would cause personal evolution eventually. Based on these late period letters I've been reading, Oswalt may have been onto something. Lovecraft explicitly repudiated fascism, renouncing many of his reactionary political views following a dramatic political transformation beginning in the 1930s. To my surprise, he turned against capitalism. In fact, if you can believe it, he was an ardent socialist by the time he died. Though he never explicitly renounces his racist views, at least not anywhere that I've found so far, they seem to be a part of the reactionary package that he does reject by name. In his letters, his prolific usage of racial slurs tapers off, and his expressions of racist ideas fade from sight. You'll find that his most reactionary writings were produced in the 1910s and 20s. That period of his life is the man that most people simply know as Lovecraft. But in the 1930s, the rougher edges appear to have been sanded off. And I don't want to overstate his evolution, but many of his reactionary views did not seem to follow him into the 30s. So, fair warning, those who would like to be spared some culture war ranting should skip to the next section where we get to the letters. This is relevant to Lovecraft for reasons that will become obvious, if they aren't already. So for those who are just listening to hear Lovecraft's recently uncovered letters, you might just skip this next part. The bottom line is that you can adore an artist's work without it being diminished by moral or ideological concerns, and further that this is in every sense a much better ethos than what is currently the norm, set by the secular counterparts of church ladies. Form an absolute division between art and artist? Probably not, and certainly not in the case of Lovecraft. Who he is matters in relation to his fiction and mythos. His own fragile, paranoid, and diseased mental state shades the mental states of his victim protagonists, the character of his mythos, and the narrative arcs of his stories. For more details regarding his inner life, see the section on Lovecraft's biography from the episode I made about him a couple years ago. He seemed socially stunted and suffered from a unique set of anxieties and various abnormalities. Anyway, at least in some sense, separating the art from the artist is not even desirable. Finding aesthetic value apart from moral and political ideology, however, is a necessary skill. If we don't nurture this ability, what will be left? How many artists live up to your moral and political standards? And why would one deprive oneself in this way? I think we must try to learn to separate aesthetic value from moral or political value. If we don't learn to separate artistic quality from moral quality, the results will be predictable. Every movie will become a secular version of a Christian movie. All the masterful filmmaking skill we see on display in Christian movies just promoting different values. Every analysis will be that of a secular church lady who says, "This was good because it affirms my moral beliefs, but that was bad because it doesn't affirm my moral beliefs. Because that author was racist, his fiction sucks. Because that comedian did something bad, he's no longer funny. Because this movie depicts something morally impermissible, it's a terrible movie. Because someone used bad words, this is a bad work of art. Doesn't matter if it was the creator or a character in the story. I've even heard, this comedy special isn't any good because it doesn't help advance positive social change. Personally, I don't want to live in a world where every movie is a Christian movie and every moviegoer is an old church lady. I don't think every work of art is supposed to be a moral or ideological vehicle whose purpose is to effect positive change. Though this would be an augmentation of every awful change that we've witnessed over the past decade, it seems to be the implicit desire of many, if not the explicit goal. Here's where I and those who have disagreed with me so far can at least find some sort of common ground. This is our situation. We cannot fully separate art from artist, at least in some sense. Nor should we. Those who make movies and books and shows we love will always be of some interest to us, as will their intent. It's an ironic fact that many who think authorial intent is paramount also emphatically demand that we separate art from artist. You know, sometimes you'll hear the separate art from artist thing from conservatives, who also are extremely anti-postmodernist and think that authorial intent is just the most important thing, if not the only thing. In any event, we must separate our moral judgment from our aesthetic judgment. Why should artists be role models? And why should every character be a role model? This carving must be further applied to the behavior of those in the book, movie, show, etc. Protagonist doesn't mean good guy who you're supposed to side with who does good things for good reasons. That's what it means in Christian movies and in Ayn Rand novels. Moral condemnation of the behavior of characters in a work of fiction shouldn't translate to aesthetic condemnation. Many of those who seem to want every movie to be a Christian movie or an Ayn Rand novel, just inserted with different values, are utterly unable to see anything on screen endorsed or depicted that they find morally objectionable. If we can't find a way to outgrow this stupidity, well, I hope you like Christian movies. So, why bother talking about the nuances of Lovecraft's character, and even defending him, if I'm arguing that it ultimately doesn't matter? Well, first off, to ask a fan of Lovecraft why they'd be interested in minutiae surrounding the artist's life and work is to utterly fail to understand fans of Lovecraft and their affliction. Second, I think it vindicates a few of us, like Oswald, who had supposed that we had detected some redeeming qualities in him. Though, let me concede once again that it ultimately doesn't matter. His improved character doesn't make me enjoy his work any more or any less. Nonetheless, it's an interesting turn of events for Lovecraft readers and fans. It's certainly a chapter of his life that many don't seem to know about. That his politics in his later years before he died at age 46 were so radically different from those of the younger man who most considered to be Lovecraft is an interesting biographical detail in itself. So, let's get to those letters. This letter to Catherine Moore, written in the final year of his life, is an incredible document for a fan of Lovecraft. To hear him rail against plutocracy and capitalism is quite interesting, not to mention his explicit repudiation of his younger self, which again, most of his fans conceived to be Lovecraft. Quote, "Capitalism is dying from internal as well as external causes, and its own leaders and beneficiaries are less and less able to kid themselves. I'm no economist, but from recent reading I've been able to form a rough picture of the dilemma. The need to restrict consumers' goods and to pile up a needless plethora of producing equipment in order to maintain the irrational surplus called profit which has caused orthodox economists like Hayek and Robbins to admit that only starvation wages and artificial scarcity could stabilize the profit system in the future and avert increasing cyclical depressions of utterly destructive scope. Laissez-faire capitalism is dead. Make no mistake about that. The only avenue of survival for plutocracy is a military and emotional fascism, whereby millions of persons will be withdrawn from the industrial arena and placed on a dole or in concentration camps with high-sounding patriotic names. That or socialism. Take your choice. All this from an antiquated mummy who was on the other side until 1931. Well, I can better understand the inert blindness and defiant ignorance of the reactionaries from having been one of them. I know how smugly ignorant I was. End quote. His harshest words are for capitalism, which he describes as a, quote, crazy orgy of legalized corruption. Under capitalism, he writes, quote, the chief corruption is actually legalized under the name of private profit. Industry should be socialized by degrees, and only as soon as the mass of people are ready to back up the various absorptive moves. The government must dictate hours and wages and see that employment is universally spread. If private industry can meet such rigidly enforced demands, well and good. If not, and it probably can't, absorption will be in order. End quote. He's in favor of gradual socialization rather than violent revolution, and he pokes fun at Marxists, which, who hasn't? Quote, I can't see that socialism would hurt anybody who's willing to work and who expects a just return from the work he performs, including guarantees of proper security in old age, and in times of necessary unemployment or disability. A few can reason and can see that capitalism is automatically doomed by the natural course of economics unless upheld by fascist bayonets. End quote. And you may have caught this earlier. One passage of the letter to Moore echoes Rosa Luxemburg's famous socialism or barbarism slogan. Quote, the only avenue of survival for plutocracy is a military and emotional fascism, whereby millions of persons will be withdrawn from the industrial arena and placed on a dole or in concentration camps with high-sounding patriotic names. That or socialism. Take your choice. In his 1934 letter to Helen Barlow, he defends communists from the harsh criticisms of his correspondent. Quote, it must not be thought that all communistic belief is synonymous with deterioration. Actually, there are many persons of the highest character and most impeccable background who honestly think that a general communistic program forms the only ultimate solution of the present breakdown of capitalism, a belief which they derive from the abstract and impersonal study of national resources and their distribution. In which does not, of course, necessarily involve any endorsement of the sudden social changes and absurd formal ideologies advocated by the orthodox Marxians and discontented European riffraff. Such persons do not wish to see all traditions and settled ways of living ripped up indiscriminately, but they do feel that mankind will not be able to continue its civilization unless its stagnating inequalities of resources and opportunities are eventually diminished through some far-sighted plan of distribution and some adequate way of enforcing that plan. To them, some sort of communism seems to be the only way to enforce a civilization-preserving economic plan, hence they believe it will have to come in the end. The number of these honest and analytical communists, or semi-communists, seem vastly on the increase. End quote. Make no mistake, it's not as if he became a man of the people. And he certainly did not have any sympathy for the Soviet Union, though neither did Emma Goldman or Noam Chomsky, both socialists. This 1934 letter to Barlow isn't quite as stark as his 1937 letter to Moore, and the hostility of Barlow to socialism of any kind had him seeming almost apologetic. I drew from three of his correspondences, one in 1934, 1936, and 1937. The 1937 letter, written to Catherine Moore, is the one in which his socialism is most strident, least apologetic, and most consistent. Whereas, in his 1934 letter, for instance, his political ideology seems muddled and incoherent. Were you to only read one of his letters, his 1937 letter, written in the year of his death, is the one. In his 1936 correspondence to Arthur Seacrest, Lovecraft predicts the coming prosperity of the Scandinavian nations. Quote, "The nations of Scandinavia form a very hopeful sign, for there the plutocrats are gradually backing down under the combined pressure of increased government supervision and the competing system of consumers' cooperatives. England is also well on the way. The United States has the handicap of a lawless pioneer tradition, which exalts an individual gain to a grotesque extent. But even here, the Northern European temperament has softened the savagery of reaction." Nothing like a bit of biological essentialism, just to let you know the old Lovecraft is still there somewhere. Though it should be noted that he goes on to disparage the KKK as, quote, backward fundamentalists. Quote, "I read the old Communist Manifesto many years ago, and even though then wholly out of sympathy with it, was impressed by some of the isolated points it brought out. Today I would sympathize on more counts, but even so would not give it a 100% endorsement. There is no question of the vast intelligence and farsightedness of Marx and Engels, and of the basic importance of the large economic principles they discovered and formulated. The only mistake is to think that every ramification they developed and every inference they drew is infallibly accurate and worthy of slavishly literally following under every conceivable set of circumstances. The major discovery as to general drift is sound. Some people seem never able to realize that no great discovery comes forth without attendant clouds of error and half-truth." End quote. Lovecraft goes on a long rant in his letter to Moore on the corrosive effects of the profit motive on art. Though he was never able to make a decent living on his fiction, he was the quintessential starving artist, he mentions in a letter that lack of decent pay would ward off the, quote, mercenaries, and only leave the true lovers of the weird remaining. Quote, "The war between honest human expression and the profit motive is eternal and truceless." End quote. Perhaps he saw clearly what was to come. In the endless barrage of superhero movies, lowest common denominator entertainment, and the terrible death of mid-budget movies, Lovecraft's rant seems prophetic. Quote, "Bourgeois capitalism gave artistic excellence and sincerity a death blow," he writes, "by enthroning cheap amusement value at the expense of that intrinsic excellence." End quote. According to Lovecraft, the blame for the deteriorating influence of quote-unquote commercialism on the human psyche and the quality of art cannot be solely attributed to the impulses of a few bad apples. The, quote, "greed-breeding capitalistic order will never fail to generate and reward those actors. So they will continue to, quote, work the poor devils as cheaply as possible, throwing them out to starve when they're superfluous, and cash in on their present dwarfed tastes and faculties." He also writes, quote, "and when bourgeois capitalism found it profitable to reach down to the still submerged elements and cater to their crippled, repressed, and grotesquely uniformed tastes, this huge market merely aggravated the trend away from real excellence towards showmanship and charlatanry. The suave bosses of a business, quote-unquote, civilization, have no wish to improve the masses, rather the reverse." End quote. Lovecraft's objection to capitalism was not just economic, but moral and aesthetic. He saw the conflict between artistic excellence and a capitalistic order, and he argued that the privately controlled, free market economy would turn us into the worst versions of ourselves. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time.
Never before so much paralyzing terror.
Though the golden light of late afternoon gave the ancient roofs and decrepit chimneys an air of mystic loveliness and peace, I could not help glancing over my shoulder now and then. I would surely be very glad to get out of malodorous and fear-shadowed Inn's mouth.
While their heads were the heads of fish with prodigious bulging eyes that never closed.